This is the second day of this July 2015 seven-day session. And we'll return to our text from a book called The Original Face, which is an anthology of Rinzai Zen, translated and edited by Thomas Cleary. And the part we're reading is by a Zen master, Daikaku, of the 13th century. And he lays this out in the form of a dialogue. We left off yesterday with him saying how distinguishing between the ordinary conventional way, at the time, the conventional way of thinking of realizing enlightenment as taking many, 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 many lifetimes, contrasting that with Zen, which understands this seeing through, in how one can realize Buddhahood instantaneously by seeing through this whole matter of discrimination. Seeing what is beyond cause and effect. Cause and effect is one way, one form of discrimination or relativity that you can, forms one side of this coin with that has been called the twofold truth. So one side of the coin is everything in the realm of relativity, cause and effect, high and low, this and that, time, space, change, karma, and then the other side is just the other side, undiscriminated. And then the question comes, do those who realize Buddhahood by seeing reality not depend on cause and effect? Should they not cultivate virtue? Again, as we said yesterday, this question is coming out of an understanding of the Dharma as being based on merit, working your way up this ladder of karma, this evolutionary scale, working your way up through meritorious deeds. In the time of Daikaku, let's call him his Chinese name. This is a Chinese master, so let's use his Chinese name, Lan Shi Dao Long. So we'll call him, let's use the surname, Lan Shi. Lan Shi. Remember that. Lan Chi. Lan Chi is pointing out that there's something beyond cause and effect. So in response to the question, although those who realize Buddhahood by seeing their true nature may cultivate virtue, they do it for others' benefit, not for rewards. In the time of Lan Chi, lay people, the most they could hope for as a lay person was to pile up a lot of merit by giving to the monks and the monasteries. And even to this day, that's widely done out of self-interest. Okay, if I do enough good for the local temple, then in my next lifetime, I'll be able to become a monastic, a monk or a nun. But here, Lan Shi is not having any of this. So people on this path, the path of Zen, may indeed cultivate virtue, but for others' benefit, not for rewards to oneself. because, he continues, because they teach and transform sentient beings, they teach cause and effect. Because they know they have no personal gain, they do not depend on merit. They have no mind at all. This requires a little bit of explanation. Sentient beings always, in these old Chinese texts, the phrase sentient beings always means the unenlightened, those who have not yet awakened to their inherent enlightenment. So that's sentient beings. So he says here, because those who have realized Buddhahood work with sentient beings, those who have not yet awakened, they teach cause and effect. There's nothing false about cause and effect, the teaching of karma, or even the teaching of merit. It's just that it's just half the story. And if we, and what Zen offered was a counterbalance when it arrived on the scene in about, with Bodhidharma in the 6th century, after some thousand years of Buddhism before it, it offered this, some balance to this obsession with merit. But let's not deny that our actions have effects. There is this realm of cause and effect. And what we do will affect our future lives, or just our future, period. But not to depend on it. This is what he says. Because they know they have no personal gain, well, this is what awakening reveals, is that there is no self to acquire anything. So after awakening, one's generosity to others, one's working for others is understood. One understands that it's one's getting nothing out of it. Because there is no one. There is no self. They do not depend on merit. Not attached to merit. And then finally, they have no mind at all. What the heck does this mean? That's what the questioner asks. What is no mind? If there is no mind at all, who sees reality? Who awakens to the way? And who can expound the way to teach? This is, the questioner may not know, but this is the $64,000 question. Who's listening to this talk? Don't just say your name. That doesn't mean anything. It's just a label that you were assigned when you were born. Who is hearing? Lanshi continues, no mind means that there is no deluded, foolish mind. It does not mean there is no mind to discern false from true. If one doesn't think of sentient beings, that is, if you don't categorize people as unenlightened, doesn't long for Buddhas either, that is, one isn't grasping for some supposed enlightenment outside oneself, doesn't think of illusion or seek enlightenment, doesn't go along with the honor of others, does not hope for fame, profit, support, or reputation. Support would mean these monks wanting being concerned because they're completely dependent on the donations of the lay people. Does not hope for fame, profit, support, or reputation, does not shrink from attacks from those who are resentful or hostile, and does not add any discriminating thoughts about any good or evil, one is called a no-minded wayfarer or practitioner or monk. In other words, there is no self-concern. When there is no self-concern, then this is the quality of no-mindedness. When one is not dividing reality into self and that which is other than self, this is the realm of no-mindedness. So here it's important not to think of this term, which is a uniquely Zen term, I think, that no-mindedness, not to equate it with a word we sometimes use in English, mindlessness. Mindlessness seems to connote a state of distraction, or one is not a lack of awareness, mindlessness. But no-mindedness means one is drawing from that which is beyond our ordinary mind, our discriminating mind, our conceptual mind. In Buddhism also, no-minded is not the same as a sixth sense. In our own culture, we talk about a sixth sense as being some kind of paranormal way of apprehending things. But in Buddhism, we consider thinking as the sixth sense. The first five ordinary senses, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching or feel, those five, and then the sixth is thinking, or the mind with the small m. But then what is beyond these functions of consciousness that leads us into no mind? Japanese Zen master Bankei talks about this quite a bit. He uses the term the unborn Buddha mind. And he, as an example, he uses this over and over in his teaching. You're sitting and suddenly you hear the sound of a crow cawing. That perception that has nothing to do with intention or will, this is the functioning of our Buddha mind. So, semantics matter in understanding Zen. Sometimes we spell mind with a capital M, sometimes we spell it with a small m. Small m mind means these functions of the so-called higher brain, the brain functions. But mind with a capital M is far more mysterious. One of Lan Shi's descendants in Zen, Aesai, Eisai was the first of the Rinzai masters in Japan, or Japanese Rinzai masters. He said the following about mind. Great is mind. Heaven's height is immeasurable, but mind goes beyond heaven. The earth's depth is also unfathomable, but mind reaches below the earth. The light of the sun and moon cannot be outdistanced, yet mind passes beyond the light of the sun and moon. The macrocosm is limitless, yet mind travels outside the macrocosm. How great is space, how great the primal energy. And yet, still, mind encompasses space and generates the primal energy. Because of it, heaven covers and earth upbears. Because of it, the sun and moon move on, the four seasons pass in succession, and all things are generated. Great, indeed, is mind. Another way to understand this no mind is it is the mind of non-differentiation. It's a mind that is undivided into this and that, to subject and object. No mind is a mind that is not scored, not marred. This realm of no mind is one that everyone here can reach in the course of a sesshin. And for that matter, outside sesshin, but especially likely to in sesshin, or doing so much sitting. Anytime we can just lose ourselves in absorption in the breath or the koan, shikantaza, anytime we can just completely lose ourselves in that, then we are drawing closer to this no mind, drawn into no mind, out of discrimination. It's like the dark side of the moon. I guess that our image of the moon, what we can see of the moon, with the so-called man in the moon, that topographical image, is all that we ever see. But there's this other side. Question: are there differences of more or less merit in fasting, upholding the precepts, and reading and reciting sutras and dharani? So this, the questioner still is focusing on merit. And if indeed Lan Shi presents this as in dialogue form, and poses the questions himself on paper, then it's no doubt because he recognizes that merit is foremost in the mind of his monks, his listeners, or his readers. He knows he has to address that. If their main concern is merit, then he needs to meet them where they are. So are there differences of more or less merit in these different practices? And then he responds, eating once a day removes greed for food and results in great blessings and virtue in the coming life. Morality and discipline is also to stop bad states of mind and produce a good mental state. Those with good minds live in human and heavenly realms in the highest estates. Again, these are the two highest of the six realms of unenlightened existence. Since those who read the sutras and protect and maintain the teachings of the enlightened ones, these people will have great knowledge and wisdom in the coming life. So he's acknowledging, as I was just doing a few minutes ago, he's acknowledging that maintaining discipline in various ways and doing these traditionally meritorious deeds, like reading the sutras, that these things do advance our cause in terms of our the state of existence we will find ourselves in. This alone is a reason to uphold the precepts and be generous and kind and to others, is so that we may find ourselves more likely to encounter the Dharma. So the lower of the four of the six, the lower four, the lowest four of the six realms of unenlightened existence, that is the ones other than humans and devas, the realm of hell, the realm of hungry ghosts and thirsty spirits, the realm of animals, and the realm of what are called asuras, or fighting demons. In these realms, one doesn't really encounter the Dharma in a way where one can run with it. So we want to have this extraordinary privilege of encountering the Dharma in order to be able to practice and realize what is beyond all these six realms of unenlightened existence. So he acknowledges that, yes, these things will have good effects. Then he says, no mind is the Buddha mind. The qualities of this enlightened mind cannot be reached by words or thought. It is truly inconceivable. So it's another realm altogether. Terms such as advancing or regressing don't apply to this realm of no mind. How could they, when there is no higher or lower, no enlightened or unenlightened, no this or that? Question. Such roots of goodness as these each have their own merit, undoubtedly, but what is the virtue of no-mindedness? Answer. Learning the standards of conduct of the Buddha, transmitting the sayings of the Buddha, and extolling the names of the Buddha have merit, so mindless wayfarers must also have merit. If you say no mind has no merit, then other practices cannot have any merit either. So from the point of view of no merit, that covers everything. But then from the point of view of merit, certainly to be no-minded is the most positive thing, in that it lifts us above this whole progressing and regressing dichotomy. He continues, all roots of virtue and good qualities are conditional, whether they be heavenly or humanly mundane. No mind is immediate witness of the path of enlightenment, so its merit cannot be adequately expressed in words. Really, it is the condition of the one great matter. The afflictions of birth and death die away of themselves. Mind and body are one thusness. This is what it is. He used the word condition. So that's another word for no mind. It is the unconditioned. As long as we are caught in the world of conditions, the world of phenomena, then we are vulnerable, because conditions are always changing, and we change, have to change with them. But this realm of no mind, or the unconditioned, is beyond that. This is not just abstract philosophy. It really is something that we apply in Sesshin, where we see ourselves rising and falling according to changing conditions, the conditions of the mind, conditions of the environment. We see the mind sometimes more concentrated, sometimes less concentrated. We see ourselves facing different emotional conditions, emotional states. How to ride out these waves? It is by dwelling in this realm of no mind that we may be the breath practice or the koan practice or shikantaza. By dwelling in these in our practices, these different practices, we are able to stay afloat, maintain detachment from the effects of these changing conditions. It's really very simple, ultimately. If you want to have the easiest ride possible through Sesshin, just continually return your attention to the practice, just the practice, and hold it there as long as you can, and then when the mind drifts, come back to the practice. It's just that easy. Just absorption in the practice, everything else becomes easier. Everything smooths out, becomes lighter. We just do that one thing, absorption in the practice, and the practice exclusively, nothing else. Question. The sutras do not speak of no mind, nor do they praise it. By what school of teaching do you esteem this? Boy, it's hard to know. There are so many sutras hundreds of them, maybe thousands, I don't know, way, way more than are translated into English. So can we confirm that there is no mention of no mind in the sutras? It would have to be, of course, a translation. But let's say there is no explicit reference to the phrase no mind in the sutras. Let's give the questioner that. So then Lanshi says, various sutras have not failed to speak of it. Some say, quote, the path of words ends. Some say, it cannot be explained. Or, ultimate emptiness. Or, the condition of the one great matter. So Lanshi is pointing out that though that phrase may not be found in the sutras, there are these other references to it, saying the same thing. And also they say that all things are quiescent and at rest. Shakyamuni shut his room, Vimalakirti closed his mouth. Does this not point to no mind? This allusion to Vimalakirti is one of the most famous of the enlightened lay people in the Zen tradition. He was a man of means who came to enlightenment, great enlightenment, and there was this situation where various bodhisattvas were asked to sum up their understanding of the Dharma, and one after another gave what reads as pretty profound statements. And then at the end, Vimalakirti just remained silent. Sometimes called the thundering silence of Vimalakirti, pointing to no mind. Lanshi continues, although there are 84,000 entrances to the truth in the teachings, they do not go beyond form and emptiness. This is an unusually direct way of summarizing the Dharma. Although there's so many, 84,000 is a kind of a conventional designation for beyond number, 84,000. In the Three Pillars of Zen, somewhere in there, there is the reference to this body of 84,000, 360 bones and 84,000 pores. So though there are these countless numbers of ways of teaching and approaching the teaching, they do not go beyond form and emptiness. This is the basic polarity of all reality, all existence. These are the two sides of the coin again. He continues, everything that has form and characteristics is matter or form, body. That which does not show any form is empty. Because the body has form, it is called material, and because the mind is formless, it is called empty. None of the sutras goes beyond these two things, form and emptiness. And by the way, none of the koans go beyond these two, form and emptiness. They can't explain the sphere of no mind, so they don't extol this matter. That is, the sutras can't explain no mind. Because words cannot reach it, it is called the special transmission outside of the teaching. And that's the designation for Zen, even back in Lanxi's time and way back before that. Zen is a special transmission, does not rely on words. Question, is this body then to be considered illusion? Can it be considered enlightenment? And what is the mind? The basis of illusion and enlightenment, it should be known. And is the mind inside the body or outside the body? Where does it come from? Lanxi, the body of four gross elements, this was the old way of describing all form, all physical things, fire, water, earth, and air, the four elements. The body of four gross elements and five clusters, these are the five skandhas, fills the universe. All sentient beings are the foundation. Causes and conditions interact to form physical bodies. This is called birth. When the results of the causes and conditions change and die out, then the four elements disperse. This is called death. Very clean, simple way of understanding the arising and falling away, the appearance and disappearance of all things. All things are the result, the effect of causes and conditions, primary causes, secondary causes, conditions. When they all come together, then this is birth. And when they disperse, when these causes and conditions, which are always in flux, when they disperse, then this is death. And this is not to be understood only in terms of the birth and death of the body. Yes, that for sure. But the arising and disappearance of anything, a partnership, a business partnership, where two or more people come together, conditions, circumstances are such that they're able to form a partnership. And that partnership then will last until those conditions and circumstances change enough to disperse, and then the partnership ends. It's the same in any relationship. Marriage. A relationship short of marriage. The causes and conditions that we call the one partner joins together with the causes and conditions that we call the other partner. And then so long as those causes and conditions obtain in more or less the same way, then there will be this existence of the partnership. And then when they no longer obtain, then there is the end of the partnership. Remember, there was a short period when Roshi Kaplow at weddings would make this point, where he would always, before the actual vows were taken in the weddings, most of them were in the dining room at Arnold Park, and sometimes elsewhere, and would give a short talk about some of the terms in the wedding vows, and then he would, just to kind of help guests, non-Sangha guests, understand more what this matter of wedding, or marriage, is all about, he would say something like, for this 1 year, I think, that I remember, he would say, "So, you, Jennifer, and you, Jason, have come together because it is your karma to come together. And when your karma changes and no longer is there, exhausts itself, then you will be apart." Poor guests would blink their eyes. He was speaking the truth. He was speaking the truth. This is how it is. We don't need to make a big melodrama out of it. This is the way it works. This is the Dharma. We come together because we have a karmic affinity with one another. That's not perpetual, that karmic affinity. It may last a longer time or a shorter time. Who knows? Maybe it could last lifetime after lifetime. But when that affinity is no longer sufficient to keep two people together, then they part. I myself wouldn't use this as an occasion to outline how karma works at a wedding, but you can't fault it in terms of the truth of it. Unfortunately, with marriage and other partnerships, people part before the karma has exhausted itself. If the karma has exhausted itself, then there is an amicable, clean parting. And probably, I suppose, then they would remain friends on good terms. But it seems that more often there is anything but amicability. There is bitterness and resentment. And that's always a sign that there is still karma to be worked through. Maybe next time around. All right, let's wrap this up and recite the four vows.